Welcome to Season 5 of the Fashion Law Network podcast. I'm your host, Kasia Zabrowska-Traubin, patent attorney and fashion enthusiast based in Los Angeles, California. Join me as I break down legal cases, discuss recent fashion news, and demystify patent law. Hello, and welcome to Season 5, Episode 2 of the Fashion Law Network podcast. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. I have a great episode today. I'm going to be discussing the current landscape of department stores. During my research for this episode, I came across so many articles with titles like "The End of the Department Store Era is Coming to a Close" or "The Demise of Department Stores." But then one glaring exception I kept coming across was the luxury American department store Neiman Marcus. As the global economy is transitioning right now with rising interest rates, which seem to be lowering economic demand, how is Neiman Marcus doing so well financially with their sales up over 30% in the last quarter? Not to mention that Farfetch just invested $200 million in Neiman Marcus. This is especially astounding considering Neiman Marcus's recent history, when in May of 2020, Neiman's became the first major department store group to file for bankruptcy protection during the pandemic. They ended up exiting the bankruptcy about 6 months after that. Not to mention, concurrently, Neiman Marcus was also embroiled in a major legal battle with hedge fund Marble Ridge Capital. Now, this battle reads like a legal thriller book, complete with what the press called a nemesis. And then in a dark turn of events, the so-called nemesis ended up getting arrested in September of last year. So I'll go over the details of that case in the second half of this episode, and I already discussed a lot of the details in that legal battle in episode 7 of season 2 of my podcast series, but there have been so many developments since, so I'll provide you guys with those interesting updates. Now, what does Neiman Marcus know that's been eluding all the other department stores that are currently struggling? We're going to get into all the details here. But first, I'm just going to quickly discuss a background of the iconic Neiman Marcus department store, as I know I have so many international listeners who may not be familiar with Neiman's, as it's only located in the United States, although the online store is, of course, accessible to everyone, and they do ship internationally. Neiman Marcus has a very rich and interesting history. It was started back in 1907 in Dallas, Texas, and it was founded by Herbert Marcus and his sister Carrie Marcus Neiman and his brother-in-law Al Neiman. The trio's initial investment was $25,000, and this store was very unique for the time. It was lavishly furnished and stocked with clothing of a quality that was not commonly found in Texas at the time. Within a few weeks of opening the store, the inventory was completely soiled out. Oil-rich Texans welcomed the opportunity to flaunt their wealth in a more sophisticated fashion than was previously possible, and they all flocked to the new store, opened by the trio. Now, Stanley Marcus was in charge of the company's operations, and he really further established the store. Also, by the way, he wrote a great book titled Minding the Store. It was his memoir, and I highly recommend it. I'll put the link to it in the episode notes if anybody would like to read it. Then things took a turn when Stanley Marcus died in 2002. He had served as president and chairman of the board for the company, and Marcus had been the architect behind all the fashion shows, the New York advertising, in-store art exhibits, and of course the Christmas catalog with these really out there his and hers gifts, like a pair of airplanes or a pair of race cars I think they had a couple years ago. Now, over the last 20 years, ownership of Neiman's has been passed through several hands. Neiman Marcus is currently owned by the Canadian-based Canada Pension Plan Investment Board and LA-based Ayers Management, A-R-E-S. Of note is that Neiman Marcus is also the owner of MyTeresa.com, which is a luxury fashion e-commerce store. highly recommend it. They have a great selection of items. In 2004, Neiman Marcus acquired mytheresa.com, which is actually German-based, and also their flagship store in Germany called Theresa. Now, remember this fact for later in this episode, because it's going to come up again when I discuss the legal battle with that investment firm, Marble Ridge. Personally, I am a very loyal Neiman Marcus shopper. Neiman's has been my favorite department store for as long as I can remember. I have their store credit card, and I love their InCircle Rewards program, which at the time when they first started was novel. I don't believe there were many other stores doing these rewards clubs. Of course, now a lot of them have jumped on the bandwagon, but to me, there's something just so special about Neiman Marcus compared to any department store. Their sales associates are like none other. They're really focused on attention to detail. And of course, they're also famous for their in-store cafes, and the famous popovers that they have are beyond amazing. If you have a chance to go, I highly recommend it. And I've actually had a few parties for some of my major life events at their restaurants, and they just have done an impeccable job with decorating. I remember I had one of my baby showers thrown for me there, and it was just amazing. I wish I had taken more pictures so I could show you guys. So as I mentioned earlier, in May of 2020, Neiman's filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and they cited inexorable pressure from the pandemic. So now, just quick by way of really general bankruptcy law, Chapter 11 bankruptcy is a reorganization, while a Chapter 7 bankruptcy is a liquidation. So in a Chapter 7, everything in the company is sold off, and then the proceeds go to pay off the creditors. A Chapter 7 is a pretty bleak option to take, but sometimes it's necessary where the business totally, you know, gets shut out and the banks that have lent the company money over the years are not likely to get their money back. Typically, for all parties involved, you'd prefer a Chapter 11. This is because the lenders want to get paid back, and the best way of doing this is by having the business continue to operate and be profitable. So a Chapter 11 bankruptcy typically helps a company restructure their debts and obligations while remaining open for business, at least temporarily. And then if all goes well, you exit the Chapter 11. So this is what happened to Neiman Marcus. If a plan for operating the business is agreed upon, or if there's a sale reached. So courts typically want businesses to succeed, so the Chapter 11 reorganization bankruptcy route is preferred versus a liquidation. Obviously, it's also better for the economy in that the business proceeds continue being operational and profitable. So when Neiman's announced that they emerged from their Chapter 11 reorganization protection, that's what was meant by that, and they had a restructuring plan that eliminated, or they were forgiven, $4 billion in debt and $200 million in annual interest expenses. So that was already such a huge hurdle for a business to overcome, but they ended up doing it successfully, and now their sales are soaring. So let's talk about why that might be. So first, just to get some context, I'm going to paint a picture verbally for you guys for the kind of bleak landscape that most department stores are currently in. So according to bestlifeonline.com, they state that the demise of department stores has been ongoing for more than a decade now, and it was only exacerbated by the pandemic. According to the Washington Post, roughly 40% of all department stores in the U.S. have closed since 2016. Some companies totally went out of business, like Barney's. I have an episode about that one where I discuss all of the kind of bankruptcies that were happening during the pandemic when I was doing my podcast. Also, Lord & Taylor have gone out of business completely. There are some major chains that have managed to survive, but they are facing major setbacks. Kohl's, Macy's, Nordstrom's are allegedly all trying to stay afloat in the face of these new economic challenges. Of course, I'm sure you guys have heard, inflation in the US is the main ongoing concern. the annual inflation rate hit 9.1% in June of 2021, which according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics is the highest increase in 40 years. So in economics, just for somebody who's not familiar with financial terms, inflation is the general increase in the prices of goods and services in an economy. So inflation corresponds to a reduction in the purchasing power of your money. Your money is basically not as powerful as it used to be. And even with inflation falling to 8.5% in July of this year, 2022, impact is still being felt, especially when it comes to how consumers are spending their money. So according to market research firm NPD Group, more than 8 in 10 shoppers are planning to rethink or reduce their spending in the next 3 to 6 months. So of course, this is going to translate to lower spending at department stores and general shopping for non-necessities, which of course, Neiman Marcus would be. There's also another major reason why a lot of department stores are revisiting their financial outlook. The level of inventory within the industry is about 50% higher than it was last year. Macy's said their inventory increased by 7%, and Nordstrom said their inventory climbed up by 10%. And according to the New York Times, consumers are cutting down on their spending. And so this is why retailers are stuck with more inventory than they need. It's basically unprecedented. There has never been this much excess inventory, as seen especially in these large department stores now. So this, of course, may translate to a benefit for consumers because these large department stores have to somehow get rid of all this extra inventory. So in my opinion, I think there's going to be some huge sales coming up because these stores just have to get rid of all this excess inventory, especially with the change of the seasons. All of the new fall winter clothing is going to be coming in, and they're just stuck with all of this warm weather summer clothing. This goes for department stores, of course. So how in the world did Neiman Marcus not fall into this trap? According to Forbes.com, while many other retailers took a huge hit this year, as we just discussed, Neiman Marcus Group reported its sales in the most recent quarter to over 30% growth compared to the same time last year. In addition, nearly half of Neiman stores reported all-time high sales volumes, and overall sales of its top 20 brands have increased over 70%. The CEO of Neiman Marcus is quoted as saying, his name is Von Redmink, that consumers who spend more than $10,000 a year account for almost half of the company's sales, despite these economic headwinds, including high inflation. He attributed the bump to the company's differentiated business model, where consumers can engage with 3,000 sales associates in stores, online, in a remote setting. He also said there has been a really strong demand for luxury stores and handbags, as well as a massive acceleration in men's items, which he pointed out to an increase 60%. So that's interesting. I never thought about that, that men are maybe what's driving this huge increase of sales at Neiman Marcus. The CEO further goes on to say that the customers are very loyal, engaged in luxury, and he also noted that if we look at the customers who spend more than $10,000 with us per year, the one we recruited post-COVID is 6 years younger than the one they had pre-COVID, which indicates that a younger generation is really significantly engaging in luxury. And I remember reading pre-pandemic when I was preparing for my season two episode, that the problem that Neiman's had with their consumer base was that they were kind of aging. They were 50 years old or older, and the problem was that they weren't really engaging in like the new emerging designers because they were just from a different generation. But now it looks like they've somehow tapped into this younger generation, and that is a huge driver of their sales. Now, here's just a fun little bonus lawsuit discussion that Neiman's is involved in. It's nothing to do with intellectual property, but somewhat interesting nonetheless. And it is Neiman Marcus is suing Copley Place owners for $50 million over a breach of contract. According to thedailyvoice.com, Neiman said it lost millions of dollars after they agreed to shrink the size of their store to allow for construction of a skyscraper in Boston's Back Bay neighborhood. Copley Place is, of course, in the city of Boston. Those plans fell through, and now the retailer is allegedly suing the developer for $50 million to recoup the money they lost because of the project. They filed the lawsuit in July of 2022 against Simon Property Group, who are the owners of the Copley Place Mall in Boston. The Simon Property had planned to build a 52-story high-rise above the Neiman Marcus retail store, but to do so, the construction crews allegedly stated that they would need Neiman's to shrink their floor plan to allow room for some support structures. So Neiman Marcus, according to the lawsuit, reduced the square footage of their store, they rearranged the remaining retail space, and they moved a portion of their store to a whole separate area of the mall. The company said they knew it would hurt their business, but they would bear it because the Simon Property Group, the mall, promised Neiman's a 400,000 square foot store and to also give them $27 million to pay for renovations. However, the Simon Mall allegedly put off their plans for the high rise 10 months after signing the agreement, leaving the store to operate in these subpar conditions for 6 years. So I will keep my eyes on that lawsuit and we'll see what ends up happening with that. That will be very interesting to see. Okay, so now let's get into the Marble Ridge legal battle story here that I was mentioning at the top of the episode. So it all revolves around Marble Ridge Capital, which is a debt investment firm with a man named Dan Kamensky as the managing partner. And so this all started back in 2018 when, according to PR Newswire, the Neiman Marcus Board of Directors got a letter from this Marble Ridge Capital. And now Marble Ridge was a holder of Neiman Marcus's 8.75% senior notes and term loans. So they were a debtor. And they were challenging the validity of what Mr. Dan Kamensky called a self-interested asset transfer, asserting the company was in default under bond indentures. So Marble Ridge was focusing on a transfer of the My Teresa from the Neiman Marcus business without any consideration to private equity owners, Ayers and CPPIB. Now, if you guys recall, Ayers is one of the owners of Neiman Marcus. So PR Newswire then quotes from the letter that Blue Ridge Capital sent, which stated, and I'm quoting straight from the letter here, "These transactions appear to be an attempt to move the My Teresa business beyond the reach of existing creditors, sitting between the sponsor's equity and the valuable My Teresa assets. Now, Marble Ridge has reason to believe that the company was insolvent at the time of the transaction, and a dividend or other form of spin-off by an insolvent guarantor to its equity sponsors for no consideration has all the hallmarks of an intentional or constructive fraudulent transfer here." So basically, it looked like Marble Ridge thought that My Teresa should have been sold to satisfy some of the debts instead of this alleged transfer that they were attempting here. Now, just a quick side note, this case deals with some really complex finance issues, and I am not any type of finance expert, so I'm just going to try to do my best to give a overview explanation of what happened here. So this is all kind of what I discussed in my episode back in season 2, because I haven't gotten to the update yet. This is just for, I'm sure you guys don't remember this because it's like from almost 2 years ago now when I did that episode. So after this letter from Marble Ridge, this was December 10, 2018, I guess they weren't satisfied with the response, and Marble Ridge filed a lawsuit against Neiman Marcus and their domestic and international corporate entities in state court in Dallas. That lawsuit was based on issues delineated in that September letter, in particular that allegedly fraudulent transfer of My Teresa, which is separate from Neiman's corporate entity. And the lawsuit was seeking $1 million in damages and requested the court to avoid the transfer. So then I read the petition filed by Marble Ridge on September 10th, 2018. I'm just going to briefly go over it here. They said this fraudulent transfer and receiver action arise from a integrated two-skip scheme orchestrated by parent to loot the company. It goes on and on and on. Company is a debtor under the fraudulent transfer law. So at this point, it seems like Dan Kamensky, the owner of Marble Ridge, or the managing partner, was trying to be like a savior, I guess, in a sense here, where he's ringing the alarm bells, hey, this is a fraudulent transfer, let's, you know, get this fixed. So that's just some background here. Then the complaint goes on to describe the history of the Neiman Marcus loans. It's like a 25-page complaint. So then Neiman Marcus files their answer to that, also very detailed, and they added a few claims like business defamation in relation to some of the various statements that Marble Ridge made in their September letter to the Neiman's board. Then Marble Ridge cited theft of assets by Neiman's in their response. So then, March 2019, the court threw out the Marble Ridge case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction with prejudice, meaning that Marble Ridge can't file another lawsuit based on the same grounds. Then, as we all know, we have the Chapter 11 bankruptcy that Neiman Marcus filed for in May 2020. So, as reported by Institutional Investor, Neiman's reached a settlement over the summer with the unsecured creditors, one of which was Marble Ridge, allocating 140 million Series B shares of My Teresa to them. The problem with that was that the shares were not liquid, and some of these unsecured creditors needed cash, and so Marble Ridge proposed to buy out some of the other shares, which seemed to be like things are moving forward. And then this is where this story or legal thriller takes a very dark turn, because at the end of July 2020, when Dan Kamensky, who again was owner of Marble Ridge, he heard that another investment bank called Jefferies, well, a client of the bank, was going to make a higher bid on those My Teresa shares than what Marble Ridge had planned. And so here's Jefferies. They're trying to put together a formal bid to buy the shares from any unsecured creditor that wants to sell. And then again, according to Institutional Investor, that same day when Dan Kamensky heard that Jefferies had contacted the unsecured creditors committee and offered to buy the My Teresa shares at only 30 cents, he got really angry, and allegedly his anger got the best of him, because he allegedly started communicating with this Jefferies representative via Bloomberg chat and over the phone. And in particular, one alleged Bloomberg chat by Kamensky was pretty damaging, where he allegedly said, "Do not send in a bid." He chatted that in all capitals. And Marble Ridge was also a client of Jefferies, and he allegedly threatened to take his business if Jefferies didn't withdraw their bid. So then Jefferies told their client they're not going to put a bid on the shares, and they contacted the counsel for Marble Ridge, told them about their communications with Kamensky, which point the owner, Dan Kamensky, allegedly went into like full panic mode and made some pretty damaging statements, which I'm not going to get into, but if you guys want to find the transcript of those, yeah, I'm sure you can if you do some searching online. So then in mid-August 2020, Wall Street Journal reported that Marble Ridge is shutting down after government inquiry found that Dan Kamensky tried to suppress bidding. So that's kind of the backstory of how we got here. And then there was like a bunch of investigations, and last year in September, federal agents stormed into Dan Kamensky's home in Long Island and they arrested him on 4 counts of criminal fraud: securities fraud, wire fraud, extortion, bribery, and obstruction of justice. So that was kind of like a sad case, and it's probably tough on the attorneys that were involved in that case. But there has been some updates since. So by way of update here, so the Marble Ridge founder, Dan Kamensky, ended up entering a guilty plea for bankruptcy fraud with the U.S. District for the Southern District of New York. He had a hearing set in May with a suggested sentence of up to 18 months in prison. However, he ended up getting 6 months, and he was released after serving a little more than 2 months. His law license was also suspended a few months after he was sentenced to prison. However, another interesting fact here is that a New York court just 2 months ago granted Dan Kamensky's application for reinstatement to the bar, because he was an attorney also. Now, Kamensky has declined to comment. He's notoriously silent regarding the situation. However, I did some deep diving online, and I found a short transcript of an interview he did with a website that goes by the name of Petition LLC, and they describe themselves as, I got this from their website, a digital media company that provides edgy and analysis and commentary about financial markets with a focus on distressed investments, bankruptcy, and restructuring. So, of course, I'm sure Dan and this whole situation was on their radar. So I came across where Dan Kamensky himself responds to this case, and it's pretty interesting. So this first question here that Petition asked him was, and I'm reading straight from the transcript here, Neiman, initially you won. Discuss, how did it feel to defeat a couple of funds, BS independent directors, and a powerful law firm that had been gaslighting you for years? So here's where Kamensky responds. He says, this was never about winning or losing. This was about seeing something so wrong and brazen that it needed to be called out. By the way, he's referring to that allegedly fraudulent transfer of my Teresa here. It's not about defeating any one party or about achieving victory, as it is about righting wrongs. Throughout my whole life, he says he's committed to the rights and wrongs. Then they talk about that, where he couldn't stop himself with that interaction with Jeffries, and they say to walk your thought process there. That was where things took a really bad turn. So Kamensky says, at the end of the day, my position was vindicated by every unbiased party in the case. What happened on July 31st is somewhat unrelated to the fraudulent conveyance. Here's my notes now. So July 31st was when he had that chat, that Bloomberg chat, where he wrote that he didn't want Jeffries to make the bid. So then Kamensky continues, what I lost was my ability to manage my emotions at a particular moment in time on July 31st. When I let anger get the better of me, propelling me into an ill-fated phone call with Jeffries over their last-minute attempt to get themselves cut into a potential bondholder deal. At the time, it felt like a shakedown by Jeffries, and I didn't believe that they were real. Subsequent events have proven me wrong. Giving into my anger in that moment has forever changed my life, and I hope others can learn from my mistakes. Then there's a few other questions. You guys can read that. I'll post a link in the episode notes if you guys want to read this whole interview. Then he kind of ends off saying that as a part of his sentencing, he started teaching about what happened to him during the Neiman's case, and he says it's been really rewarding to him. And he's going to continue teaching in the fall, and his case study will be published by Harvard Business School in spring of 2022, which I tried to find, but I wasn't able to, so maybe it just hasn't been published yet. But now we have a conclusion to that crazy legal battle that I've been keeping my eye on for almost 2 years now. And that concludes this episode. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. Please come back soon for my next episode. I hope you have a wonderful day. Bye.